You're listening to the Live Free Now podcast, bringing you the news, views, tips, and tools you can use to live a free, prosperous, and healthy life. Find us online at livefreenow.show. And now your host, John Bush. This is John Bush, broadcasting on the Conscious Resistance Network YouTube channel, along with my personal profile on Facebook. Today, we are going to be talking about agorism, also known as revolutionary market anarchism. We're going to be covering a lot of stuff that can be found in the New Libertarian Manifesto by Samuel Edward Konkin III. We're going to talk about counter-economics, which is essentially those activities that defy, avoid the state. It can also be summed up as black and gray markets. We're going to talk about strategy, how to get from here to there, how we are going to create the free society in our lifetimes, if not our lifetimes, hopefully our children's lifetimes, and how we're going to change the game. So now that people are joining, let's go ahead and hop right onto it. That's all right, Fred. Thanks for letting me know. So there's comments going on, a lot of comments. So go ahead and comment. You guys have conversations. And then from time to time, I'm going to stop and see and respond and take some questions. And we'll have a conversation here, everybody. So agorism was first defined in this book here, New Libertarian Manifesto. It's actually a second edition. I used to run Brave New Books, and we were selling this one for $10. I'm glad it didn't sell because it's very special. This was written in 1980, actually. And this was a time where the libertarians were not a movement by any means. There were some libertarians in New York. There were some libertarian little pockets of libertarians, a lot of thinking and such. The Libertarian Party, when did the Libertarian Party found? If anybody knows, let me know. Samuel Edward Konkin was definitely, looks like it was in Colorado Springs, Colorado, 1971. So there was these movements, there was a lot of intellectuals, there was a lot of debate clubs, and then the Libertarian Party was founded, and they wanted to go revel in some politics. Well, there's a guy that was involved in a lot of these groups, Samuel Edward Konkin, and he was kind of fed up with it. And he realized that we need to do things differently, more radically, strike the root in order to get from here to there. And so he came up with this strategy of agorism, more than a philosophy. The philosophy is consistent libertarianism. Agorism is a strategy, revolutionary market anarchism, how we can get from here to there. And one of the most important elements of agorism is consistency. So in this book, you can get it at agorism.info. There's a PDF there. Pretty cool little website. I don't know who maintains it these days, but check it out. Let me share the screen here. Agorism.info is pretty sweet. It's very simple. Lots of good info here. The New Libertarian Manifesto can be found in PDF form. This is it right here. So we're going to go over this. We're going to use this a little bit as a guide. I'm going to give my own embellishment, and we are going to chit chat. We're going to talk about strategy on how we can create a free society. On here, we have a fan already, not this voluntarious bull crap. All right. Well, feel free to let us know what you think, and we're happy to have your input as long as it's productive and respectful. If it's not, then go ahead and run your mouth. So he starts off with statism, our condition, and he essentially describes what statism is, right? Coercive, monopolistic institutions. We are coerced by our fellow human beings. Since they have the ability to choose to do otherwise, our condition need not be this. Coercion is immoral, inefficient, and unnecessary for human life and fulfillment. Those who wish to supine as their neighbors prey on them are free so to choose. This manifesto is for those who choose otherwise, to fight back. To combat coercion, one must understand it. More importantly, one must understand what is going on, what one is fighting for as much as what one is fighting against. Blind reaction. So he talks about coercion. He talks about statism. And I define coercion as the threat of violence, where people are forced, so to speak, into doing things against their will. And of course, coercion is the mechanism that the state uses in order to control people. The state uses straight up violence where, you know, picture the cop beating someone's head in, being dragged off, being put in a cage. But also, which is more prevalent, is coercion, which is just the fear of that violence. So all they need to do really is kick some violence into gear and then threaten that violence. And they don't have to literally be everywhere. There's just people that have this mindset, right? Like statism is a state of mind. It's not only the physical force or coercion, but it's the threat of it that controls so many people. He talks about how the state has killed so many people and been one of the biggest forces for aggression and violence and harm. And in my opinion, the state is one of the biggest things that's hindered human flourishing and human progress, and hindered the market from going about and fulfilling wants and needs in an effective and efficient way. That's unfortunate. So he goes on to say, agorism, our goal. And this is something that was really important to me, the consistency. He says, the basic principle which leads a libertarian from statism to his free society is the same which the founders of libertarianism used to discover the theory itself. And by that, he means, like Murray Rothbard talked about, the consistent application of the libertarian philosophy, which can be rooted in the non-aggression principle. So the libertarians, most people think it's wrong to initiate aggression in a private way. But the libertarians say we need to apply that ethic consistently to the state as well, whereby it's wrong for the state to initiate aggression as well. And that's a large part where libertarians diverge from all sorts of groups, whether it's conservatives or liberals or even other radicals. They're okay with the state using coercion or aggression in certain areas, right? And then you even have like the night watchman state that say the role of the government should be to protect life, liberty, and property. Well, that wouldn't be consistent with the idea of human ownership and sovereignty, that we own ourselves. We have control of our own destiny. If we're not going to be aggressed by others, we shouldn't be aggressed by the state either, whether it's public or private aggression. And of course, one of the big challenges is it's a lot easier to point out to people that it's wrong or unethical for individuals, non-state actors, to use aggression. But it's difficult because the statists, the law enforcement officers, the politicians, they have a veil of legitimacy. So whenever there's a private person attacking you or trying to mug you and you fight back, everyone's like, oh, wow, that was great. You stood up to that guy, or other people will come and help. But if you stand up to state actors that are aggressing upon you, law enforcement officers especially, then you can find yourself in a cage for committing a felony. So the libertarian philosophy is the consistency between humans. And then again, like all the deductions from first principles, like I own myself, therefore I have a right to own the fruits of my labor, therefore I have a right to protect that, a right to protect that against other people, public and private, right? And so what Konkin says is that the consistent application of the theory of libertarianism to every action the individual libertarian takes then creates the libertarian society. So if all the libertarians out there just stopped all of a sudden participating in the politics, and rather than doing that, they lived their life consistency with the philosophy of liberty, which looks like not voluntarily participating in those institutions which they find to be ethical, those institutions which violate the non-aggression principle, then voila, we would arrive at a free society. And that's easier said than done. And I think Derek Brose, who started the Conscious Resistance, is a damn good example of someone that's doing their best to live in a totally free way. I definitely have shifted my risk assessment. You know, I used to be more revolutionary with filming cops with the camera in their face. And I used to opt out of more state things. Like I drove around with no registration and no, inspection sticker. And I let my license go for a while. Then I had kids, they're 6 and 8. And my risk assessment just kind of shifted and changed. But as we're going to learn from Samuel Rekonkin and the philosophy of agorism, as we have greater density of agorists, if as our ranks swell, it'll be easier to defend one another, which then will minimize the risk of taking said actions. But at this point, there's scores and scores of people that are taking these actions. And more so than ever, it seems the state is losing legitimacy. And so that's how we get to a free society, the consistent application of the philosophy of liberty. And that's what this book is all about. Many thinkers have expressed the need for consistency between means and ends, and not all were libertarians. Ironically, many statists have claimed inconsistency between laudable ends and contemptible means. Yet when their true ends of greater power and oppression were understood, their means are found to be quite consistent. It is part of the statist mystique to confuse the necessity of ends-means consistency. It is thus the most crucial activity of the libertarian theorist to expose inconsistencies. Many theorists have done so admirably, but few have attempted and most failed to describe the consistent means and ends combination of libertarianism. So at this point in history, agorism, Samuel Konkin was taking a departure from the existing tome of libertarian thought, of libertarian activism. There were books that were put out. Murray Rothbard was doing great work. There was theorization of what a libertarian society should look like. There was the Libertarian Party, which was using political means to achieve libertarian ends. You see, there's an inconsistency there, using voting, using the political institution to achieve the libertarian ends is going to confuse things and not get you there. And it's at this point in the book that he goes on and really shares a lot about the Libertarian Party's history, which I think was pretty cool. And he points out there was a period where big, powerful capitalists like the Cocteopus came in and tried to steal elections. But, you know, this is that's essentially what libertarianism is. I'm sorry, agorism is. Then he gets into what I think is really exciting, the means. So he talks about the end, which is a genuinely free society. He shares some time talking about what this might look like. This is something that David Friedman, and there was a book he talks about. What's it called? He talks about Rothbard, David Friedman, and how they talk about what a free society might look like. A couple of the big things are Linda and Morris Tanhill. What's the name of their book? They wrote a book. I forget what it's called. Maybe somebody could point out, but they talk about one of the biggest things, the biggest problems. Somebody asks, are you foundationally libertarian? Well, I consider myself a libertarian-leaning activist and agorist. I started with libertarianism and then became an anarchist. There's a joke, what's the difference between a libertarian and an anarchist? And it's like 6 months because you find material like this, which is what I did. But Morris Tanhill and Linda Tanhill, along with Rothbard and David Friedman, postulated what a free society would look like. And there were two big things that a lot of people say, well, that's the state's function, defense and justice. And so people are like, okay, well, maybe we don't have to have the state involved in healthcare, or maybe we don't have to have the state involved in creating public parks, for example. But we do need the state involved in the dispensing of justice, in the dispensing of defense. And so they talk about what an alternative might look like. And he spent some time at the beginning of the book laying this out, I think, to give people hope, to show people what the possibilities might look like. And a lot of people are like, what does a free society look like? How would you do this? How would you do that? And I'm always careful to say, well, you know, I don't know exactly what it would look like. I don't know exactly how it would work. I don't know exactly if it would work or how long it would last. But I do know that this way of doing things sounds a lot better to me ethically and functionally in a utilitarian way than the statism, than the coercion. And so it talks about private defense, forces. These guys are all market anarchists, capitalists, so they talk about private defense companies forming up. But I also always point out there's a lot of anarcho-capitalists, and I appreciate capitalism, but really I'm a free market guy. And he talks about free market being the sum total of all human voluntary actions. That's what the free market is. And so I often like to talk about voluntary exchange or free market activities, although the free market terms have been bastardized, because I try to reach a lot of people that are left radicals, left socialist leaning radicals, not like shitty progressives, excuse me, that, you know, want to have big companies and the state help everybody. But the more radical types, I try to coalesce with them in my history of activism. And I avoid using the word capitalism with them. I talk about just voluntary exchange, non-coerced, mutually beneficial. Because when it's non-coerced, it necessarily is mutually beneficial, because rational actors wouldn't enter into an arrangement, a relationship, a contract, were it not for their own benefit. Okay. So not only could we have capitalist-like private defense forces, but we could also have mutual aid groups that defend one another, neighborhood watch groups. There's a lot of this going on. Like the Black Panther Party, for example, was a left organization that had leftist means and leftist ends, and they formed their own defense groups, and they would patrol neighborhoods that were oppressed by the cops, African-American communities. And so I like to point that out. A lot of these thinkers talk about the market forces, but there's also community forces. And I like to say that any function performed by the state can be more effectively, efficiently, justly. I often throw in equitably, not in an egalitarian way, but like equality under the law. Not the law of the state, because there can still be order, rules, contracts. All of the functions by the state can be more effectively, justly, efficiently, equitably performed by the market or through community organizations, through just communities formulating. I'm going to talk a lot about freedom cells here in a little bit as well, because this is one of the ways that we can get from here to there. I actually had a little outline, but I'm kind of digressing. And then they talk about justice, the dispensing of justice. So this could be done, and it has been, through tribes, through tribal elders, through leaders that people just respect and they look to them for support. But these guys, again, talk about more of a market function with a insurance agency. So each individual actor, each individual business has a corresponding insurance agency. Whenever there's a dispute between two actors, it's the insurance agencies that go forth and negotiate. Whenever they can't come to terms to make the other actor whole again, like a retributive type of justice, retribution, then the two insurance agencies will come to a predetermined third-party arbitrator. So we spend some time talking about that in the section about what our ends are, which is like the free society. Then he gets into where the rubber meets the road, counter economics, our means, which I've been an activist since 2002 when I learned that 9/11 was a false flag terror attack. And then I started shouting about it, researching, going further down the rabbit hole about the New World Order and the Council on Foreign Relations, the trilaterals, and the goal to create a global totalitarian technocratic state, right? Back in 2002. And then in 2007, I learned about libertarianism through the Ron Paul campaign. I'd already learned about it in some of my ethics classes, and it really resonated with me. There's an essay, I forget what it's called, about a free society. I forget who wrote it, but that was like, wow, that makes sense. And that's when I first learned about libertarianism. Then Ron Paul came around and was able to espouse it in such a succinct way. And it made so much sense. And I got around a bunch of other libertarians. But then I was like, wow, I'm a Ron Paul Republican and we're going to reform the Republican Party. And then it's like the Libertarian Party, I don't know, they don't really seem to have much going on. Then I discovered Murray Rothbard from there, and from there, agorism. And what's really been important to me has been the means to the end. How do we get there? Because we can all sit around and do videos and read books and have little discussion circles and talk about the philosophy of libertarian, and all the libertarians on Facebook and social media can just argue about that little tiny 1% of things that they don't agree about. But what I'm really interested in, what my good friend Derek Bros is interested in, what the conscious resistance is all about, is getting from here to there. And in fact, one thing that the conscious resistance adds that a lot of the agorists don't, a lot of people don't, is that internal self-work, that shadow work, right? So you got like black markets, and then you have dealing with the shadow internal self. Because what Derek says that really resonated with me was, sure, we can create a free society, but if we don't do the self-work necessary to be good people, to be a good society, then it's only a matter of time before we simply return to the statism, to the oppression, the coercion, all that stuff. But what's really been important to me is, how do we get from here to there, the solutions? And that's where counter economics comes about. So before I get to that, I'm just going to go through some of these comments real quick, and then I'll get back onto it talking about counter economics. We got Ken Shikinji, that must type really fast and really likes to say a lot. Agorism isn't consistent with market anarchy. Well, I'm not exactly sure how. Aggression is perfectly valid strategy in a free market. I would say that aggression isn't valid or ethical in any type of society. Now, the initiation of aggression, because in a market anarchist society, you can bet that if someone takes from you and they refuse, or they don't have an insurance agency. The other thing about the insurance agencies is that individual actors that don't operate within this framework, within this contract, they could get pushed out of society. And the beauty of decentralization and having competing systems of social organization would allow for competition to see experimentation, what works, what doesn't. And so if someone doesn't want to participate with the insurance agency model, for example, I don't know exactly what the best model is or what that looks like, but if they don't want to participate with that and they take from you, then they could be pushed out through aggression, or their home could be broken into to get your property back, for example. So yeah, aggression entirely, but it's the initiation of aggression that is rejected. We're about to be in a checkmate Well, here's Fred real quick. Anyone here, I'm going to bring these up. Look at this cool program. Anyone here have areas of the U.S. that will be safe once the mass rioting starts? And then we'll have to send in the military and DHS and really start cracking down, just as any authoritarian government will start doing eventually. Here in the U.S., it will be no different. I'm going to talk about some of this when we address pogroms, which are mass arrests, which Samuel Albert Konkin talks about. I'd like to think that we're not going to have mass rioting because of this coronavirus stuff. I think that it's going to turn around faster than the entire society deteriorates. But, you know, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. That's where firearms come into play. We're about to be in a checkmate of the New World Order. The game is close to over. The boot is on our faces. What's the move now for the truth movement? I disagree. I think I've always been an optimist. And I think that we have had immense progress in the past decade or so, especially since the advent of the internet. Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is a wonderful example. People are connecting. People are doing different things, not only within our little libertarian truth movement, but leftist, permaculturist, eco-villages. People are recognizing that the existing way of doing things, whether they think it's because it's destroying the environment or whether they think it's unethical because they subscribe to the non-aggression principle, people are recognizing the state in many ways is the best player on our team because they're boondoggling so much. I mean, look at the NSA leaks and the Edward Snowden stuff and Chelsea Manning. Like, the state is really quickly losing its legitimacy, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. But we now have the means to organize, to communicate, to broadcast transmissions like this. Also, I want to point out, and I learned this from Murray Rothbard, when you take into consideration how bleak and how tyrannical things were just some 300 to 400 years ago, in the Middle Ages, when people were literally being drawn and quartered, when heads were being put in stakes for everyone to see because you simply spoke out against the king or didn't go along with the king's edicts. It wasn't very long ago when we lived under the divine right of kings that everyone thought government was sent from God. Now, we still have a semblance of that through statism, thanks to the public schools in large part. But when you compare where we were to where we are now, I feel hopeful and optimistic, even though we still have regimes like North Korea and the communist Chinese. They can see the freedom. And even though they control the internet, when there's freedom out there, when people have a taste of it or an inkling and understanding that, wait a second, on the other side of the world, there's people living pretty damn free compared to where we're at. It's only a matter of time before revolution foments. And we see revolution taking place all across the world. And the beauty and the hope of agorism is that one of the things that these revolutions do, whether it's in Ukraine or whether it's the Chinese revolution that took place, the cultural revolution, or in Egypt or in Bahrain or in, all the color revolutions that were taking place in the Middle East, they always go back to the state. And they're like, the problem is the people that are in power. We need to overthrow them, overthrow the ruler, the king, and then we'll be okay. We'll put in our own guy and we'll change the constitution a little bit. What agorism offers is an abandoning of the state institution in and of itself, which is the true problem. It's not who's in control of the system that's the problem. It's the system itself. All right, let's see what we got going on. That's right. The state murdered over 260 million people in peacetime in the 20th century alone. Yeah. Democide, the death by government, is one of the biggest killers out there, way more than coronavirus will ever kill. Fred Graves points out democide. That's right. There are no rights in a free market. Well, we're just going to disagree on that. How many people are watching? It looks like 48 people are watching live right now, Christopher. You guys share this if you're watching me on my personal stream on Facebook or on YouTube. I don't know how you can share on YouTube, but Christopher thinks the state is great. Why is he hating on the state? Well, I'm a libertarian who subscribes to the non-aggression principle, and I think it's unethical for individuals, the people around me in my neighborhood, friends, family, to initiate aggression. That includes spanking children, because that's the initiation of aggression. I also think it's wrong for the government to initiate aggression, and I think the government initiates aggression in mass, and they get away with it because they have a veil of legitimacy. So that's to answer your question. Telling the truth about the state is hating. Okay. I'm not sure what that's referencing. Voluntarists are doomed. Man, you're going to be sorely disappointed. HR 2881 needed for the cryptocurrency going to be forced upon you. Yeah, there's a lot about this digital dollar. I don't know that it's going to actually be cryptocurrency. I just saw that it's going to be digital. But the beauty of cryptocurrency, even if they try to regulate Bitcoin, there's also XMR, also known as Monero, that can't be regulated. That's the point of it. The state is great. Are people joking? People have this stupid ego-bound fantasy about shooting their way through the revolution like a cowboy movie. We need professional help. Reference to Carnation Revolution in Portugal. I definitely don't want to shoot my way through anything. And I remember there's a quote by Thomas Jefferson that says, what does he say? He says that the tree of liberty must be watered with the blood of tyrants every couple generations. That doesn't sound like a good idea to me. I don't want to have to go take up arms and engage in revolution. I don't want my children to have to do that. I don't want my children's children. There's another way. And a lot of those revolutions take place because they're fighting for the existing power. They're fighting for a office. They're fighting to take over the reins of government. And that's what we ought to avoid. And that's not the revolution that's talked about here in the New Libertarian Manifesto. All right. I'm going to get back to it. All right. So counter economics. How do I take this little quote off? I'm using a program called StreamYard, if anybody likes it. Counter economics is the means. And so Samuel Edward Confkin he takes a broad definition of counter economics. A lot of people define it as black and gray markets. Confkin defines it as the actual practice of human actions that evade, avoid, and defy the state is counter economic activity. So this broadcast in itself is counter economic because we're defying the state. But to be more specific, gray and black markets are what I like to talk about when we talk about counter economics. Gray, black markets being those activities that are expressly prohibited by the government. For example, in many areas, prostitution or selling illegal drugs. That's starting to change in the case of cannabis. Gray market activities are doing those activities that require permission or permitting from the state, but you're doing them anyway. That's a gray market activity. And what Samuel Conkin talks about is engaging in the counter economy, doing these gray and black market activities, forming these organizations that can see the dissolution of the state, that can defy the state, that can avoid the state. Anybody that cheats on their taxes, some people that don't pay their taxes at all, but people that do pay their taxes and they hide this there and they avoid that there and they write this off, that would be considered counter economics. And one thing that he talks about as an educational approach to spreading agorism, and this is something that I adopted way early on. For example, as a libertarian, we would unschool our children, which was like child-led learning where you find out what their interests are. You don't have necessarily a top-down approach or a curriculum. And so as libertarians, we would bring the philosophy of libertarianism to the unschooling community. And as unschoolers and peaceful parents, we would bring that philosophy to the libertarian community. Because believe it or not, again, back to the consistency and means and ends, there's a lot of libertarians that subscribe to the non-aggression principle, yet they spank their kids, which is in violation of the non-aggression principle, right? That's a controversial thing, apparently. So we would bring the philosophy to, and then, you know, so on and so forth, like the gardening groups and the permaculture groups. And this is something I try to do now. My girlfriend and I are involved, and we go to meetings and participate in the movement and organizations here in Austin, Texas, that are all about permaculture and growing your own food and gardening and aquaponics. And we're quick to try to, you know, undermine the state any chance and any opportunity we get. But what he talks about is bringing libertarianism to counter economists and bringing the counter economy to libertarianism. So, for example, if you would like go buy pot and you live in a state where pot's illegal and you're buying pot from your drug dealer, you start talking to him about like, man, isn't the state pretty terrible? The reason why the state exists is to coerce people and to control and plunder people, you know? And the thought that you could be put in jail for selling a natural plant. What do you think about that? So you're talking to the counter economist. He doesn't know. He's a libertarian. He's a counter economist, but he doesn't know about the philosophy, right? He lives libertarianism. Just the same, you have all these libertarian party people that like to put on suit and ties and go be important and get elected and nominated within the party, their own little fiefdom. And I respect and I'm friends with a lot of people that are involved in Libertarian Party politics, but I personally think that the Libertarian Party in large part is inept and spend so much time spinning their wheels and arguing and debating when in reality, it's like, what has the Libertarian Party done for my liberty? I haven't seen the Libertarian Party in many respects reduce the size and scope of government, which is what should it be? Should be its goal. So you bring the counter economy to the least libertarians, like, oh, you're libertarian. Oh, you like Ron Paul. Oh, you're in the Libertarian Party. Well, have you heard about the counter economy, which is a way that we can genuinely create alternatives? So That's the means, counter economics. He talks in this part about creating an underground economy. And I wanted to point out here, which I think is pretty cool, the black economy, as it's called here. Check it out. This is an article on The Balance, and it talks about global financial integrity estimated the maximum that illegal international trade made in top sectors. So these are the top sectors of international black market activity: counterfeiting, drug trafficking, illegal logging, illegal mining, illegal fishing, crude oil theft, illegal wildlife, trafficking in cultural property, organ trafficking. So a lot of these things actually end up being unethical. And what we're talking about here in our area here is doing counter-economic activities that are ethical. But check this out. This article talks about Investopedia, right? It's estimated that it's 11 to 12% the estimated size of the U.S. underground economy as a percentage of GDP. That's a whole lot of people already engaging in counter economics that have been doing it, that aren't putting a philosophy to it. And then here we have where shadow economies are well established. I like that term, the shadow economy. Be a part of the shadow economy. Greece seems to be kicking butt. The United States is way down here, although there was another article I read that says America has the biggest underground economy. So that's pretty cool. Key takeaways. The underground economy includes any paid work or transaction that is not reported to the government, is therefore not taxed. That's the essence of counter-economics. During economic downturns, the underground economy grows as more workers unable to get legitimate jobs turn to working off the books. Countries with high level of taxation, government corruption, and regulatory barriers tend to have the largest underground economies. So, you know, in these times with the coronavirus and stuff, going out for a non-essential activity, if you're in a lockdown, a shelter in, that would be an example of agorism. Another example would be 3D printing a ventilator piece of equipment, even though it's not FDA approved, right? Or helping someone with some sort of underground or natural treatment that's not approved by the FDA. In many ways, Kratom, which is the business I'm in, mybravebotanicals.com, get a free ounce at bros.freeounceofkratom.com. It is counter-economic because it defies the state. They don't want people taking this, consuming this, benefiting from this. It's illegal in six states. It would definitely be counter-economic activity if you were in one of those six states, like Alabama, for example, and you were buying or selling kratom. In a little bit, I'm going to talk about cartel groups because that's an example of hardcore counter-economic activity, but they're doing a lot of nasty stuff, so that's not cool, man. All right, let's get into the section, which I really appreciate, where he talks about the different phases of counter-economics. I have some notes here. Let me make sure that I'm doing all the stuff. You know, a great way of educating people is showing people, not just talking about it, philosophizing, but showing people the counter economy at play. And a great example, everyone's like, anarchism can't work. That's just some far-fetched idea. And a great example of anarchism working is through Bitcoin. Now, mind you, Bitcoin is being regulated and a lot of people are complying with those regulations. But last time I checked, when the IRS puts out number, there are scores and scores, thousands and thousands. Who actually knows exactly how many people that are not claiming their Bitcoin transactions or cryptocurrency activity or investments to the IRS? And that's the essence of counter-economic activity. But I want to show, when people are like, anarchism can't work, this is something David Friedman said in The Machinery of Freedom that really stuck out to me, his book, Machinery of Freedom. He said, educating people, you know, theorizing, conceptualizing is one way to educate people, but showing people is another way. And I think showing, pointing out cryptocurrency when they're like, no, that can't work. It's like, oh yeah, well, a decentralized, non-government, non-state, peer-to-peer network has emerged, and it is global in nature, and there's no central authority using coercion in order to ensure its efficacy, in order to ensure that it operates justly, right? Now, there's people ripping people off, so on and so forth, but the institution itself is total agorism, total freedom, and it works, and it's a beautiful thing. Another example is a neighborhood watch group, or what the Black Panthers would do. There's new Black Panther groups that are doing the same thing, arming people, defending one another against private crime and public crime alike. And of course, defending against public crime is a lot more risky. All righty. At this point, I'd like to talk about, So there's this cool part in the book where he gets into our strategy, revolution, which is whatever, you don't need to see it. He gets into The Strategy of Revolution, Revolutionary Market Anarchism, actually building the Agora. I should point out, for those of you not familiar, Agora comes from the Greek word for open marketplace, which is, you know, rather that works pretty well. And so he talks about revolution, our means, our the, what does he say? Our strategy is revolution. And so the idea is that we agitate, we encourage people to become agorists. We encourage people to get involved in the counter economy. Simple agorists may wish to contribute to entrepreneurs specializing in accelerating the movement to the agorist society from statism. Others perceiving rising inflation heading to economic collapse or gathering clouds of war will want something done about it. Finally, the counterattacks of the state, which subvert the agorist subsociety and lure libertarians into false paths, must be combated. These tasks define the field of new libertarian activism. So we agitate, we grow the counter economy. And we create organizations of mutual defense, of mutual aid. And he gets to this part here where we have the density, different phases in society. So phase zero is a zero density agorist society. That's total statism. That's no agorism. That's voting for people. But we can start to see the agitation, the education. Vote for nobody, he says. None of the above. Boycott the ballot. Don't vote. It only encourages them. Which is something that's professed a lot here on the Conscious Resistance Network. Although Derek ran for mayor, which I didn't have a problem with. A lot of people are like, Derek, you ran for mayor. You've been saying not vote, so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's like, man, he's getting the message out. He's putting 5G on the map. He's building his following. He's building his network. So who gives a damn at this point? I used to be all like, we got to be 110% consistency. And I had my nose in the air. But it's like, man, the enemies of liberty sure are attacking us at every single junction. So it's like death by a thousand cuts. We might as well do our own thing and try to hit them from every single opportunity we get. So he goes into a low dense. So that's not actually where we are right now. I think in many ways we have low density agorism. And so let me talk about how we can get from here to there. Phase zero to phase one. Phase one is low density agorism, little pockets of agorism, more people talking about these ideas, more people thinking outside the box, more people thinking outside the state, which another a good tagline for agorism, feel free to use it, I like it, is that agorism encourages you not to compete within the state, like politics, but to compete with the state and create alternative institutions, networks that will hopefully someday rise up and compete with the state in mass and eventually replace it. And it's at this point where he talks about how we can create these alternatives. We can create the agorist society. And this ought to resonate with the people that are still participating within the state of society. For example, with cryptocurrency, when someone is using the banking system to wire money and it takes 1 to 2 days to clear and costs $20. And we're like, wait a second, you can actually send that exact same amount of money almost instantly and get charged about 15 cents to verify the transaction for the mining fee. Isn't this sound a little bit more effective and efficient for you? Don't you want to give this a try, right? And so I think right now we're in a phase one agorist society. Later on in the book, he gives his assessment that we are in a phase one, but of course this was written in 1980. What phase are we in? In October 1980, most of the planet Earth is in phase zero. The British Isles, Australia, and Canada have moved substantially towards phase one. North America is in phase one. Only in the highest concentration of libertarians today in Southern California are the first signs of phase two. So phase one, low agorist density society. The first counter-economic libertarians appear in this phase, and the first serious splits in the libertarian movement occur. We are definitely in phase one, and I like to point out the Free State Project. They have their own little agorist organizations going on, their own counter-economy taking place in the city of Keene, the Keeniacs, and in Manchester. Man, there's this really cool, I think they're still doing it, but not to the point they were before, but it's an underground agorist club where you had to have membership only. Being invited by a member, could a guest come in? And they had some crazy stuff going on there that was the essence of counter economics. And this is taking place. Now we see pockets of libertarians in Phoenix. Of course, there's pockets of libertarians in California. The Free State Project, an effort to encourage libertarians to move in mass. They already have like 1,500 to 2,000 libertarians that have made the move. In Houston, where Derek's based, there's a huge libertarian movement and community. And not even just libertarian, just anti-state in all of its forms, pro-liberty, pro-freedom, pro-justice, pro-peace. Here in the great city of Austin, I'd like to say we probably have arguably the highest density of libertarians in number in a certain given geographic area. Austin's popping, and our movement of libertarians, liberty-loving individuals has grown to the point where there's different factions, and I think that's a very beautiful thing. And we all need to work together and share ideas and thoughts. We don't have to agree wholeheartedly, and there is room for healthy debate, but this silly bickering and all sorts of crazy stuff, there's no place for that. And so whenever you move into phase two, mid-density, small condensation agro-society, which I would argue is happening in large part in with the radicals in New Hampshire, you start to get pushback from the state more often. And at this point, I'd like to talk about freedom cells. Freedom cells is a concept that essentially is the creation. It's how to get from here to there. It's a practical way to create agorism and to create a free society. And so it starts with a small group of 8 to 12 individuals of like mind, preferably that are in the same geographic area, although that's not necessary, but it's definitely beneficial, especially for your safety. You create a group of 8 to 12 individuals, and you all work together on mutual goals. Some of those goals can be everyone has food storage set up, everyone has a decentralized means of communication or an encrypted means of communication, whether it's Signal or Telegram. Everyone has firearms, access to firearms, knows how to use them effectively, proficiently in defense of themselves, their family, and their community. Everyone has a bug out plan. Everyone has a plan. They're educating, they're agitating, they're protesting, they're encouraging the creation of other freedom cell groups. And so this is essentially how it works. And the reason why it's a number 8 to 12, it's the work of Bob Podolsky in his book. Damn it, I always forget the name of the book. It might be Thrive or he talks about octologs. And him and this guy named Ryan David Garcia or John David Garcia did scientific research to determine that a group of 8 people tends to be the most creative and the most effective. Anytime you have 4 people or 15 people, you get less effective. Also, equal number of men and women was what their research found. And so that's where we kind of base the 8 to 12. But it's also a small group. When you start to get larger than that, there's infighting, there's differing agendas. And you can have a group of 8 to 12, and then maybe a bunch of other people get recruited. You split off into other groups of 8 to 12. So you have a group of 8. Then you start talking to your friends. And you're like, man, we've been doing this little freedom cell thing. We've been checking in. We have this private Telegram group. We're really helping each other to make sure that we have food storage, that we're taking necessary measures through this crazy coronavirus stuff that's going on. We all have a bug out plan. 4 of us are going this way. The other 2 with their family are going this way. And it's really working well for us. You should consider creating your own freedom cell. So now you have another group of 8 to 12, and they're like doing all this cool stuff these groups are doing. They're working together. They're not as united, and they're not as dedicated to one another as the individual group of 8 to 12, as the individual group of 8 to 12, but they're also united with the larger group. Then you keep agitating. Let's use the word 10 to make it simple, right? And so I'll just do a little show you what I'm talking about here. So let's say these are my notes. Don't look at them. It'll spoil the fun. Let's say we have a group of 10. Let me zoom in for you. We have a group of 10, a freedom cell group. Then they agitate for the creation of another group of 10. They agitate for the creation of another group of 10, and so on and so forth, right? So now we have these groups. Let's say you don't get all the way to 100. 100 is the easy way to do it. Actually, we are going to get all the way to 100. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So you have these 10 groups of 10. And the groups are at their core are dedicated to one another, the 10 members here and the 10 members here. But they also form a group of 100, and they're dedicated to the group of 100. So, for example, let's say shit hits the fan and this group, they run out of ammo. So they're like, hey, network of 100, we are out of 9mm ammo. And this group over here is like, man, we are such firearms crazies. We just stocked up on a whole mess of firearms. So they share it with them right here. Then you have your group of 100. So this is the group of 100 here. This group of 100 has been out agitating and forming other groups of 100, encouraging the formation of other groups of 100. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And so now this group, all these 10 groups of 100 form up, and they have So this I call the inner cadre. This I call the, I don't even remember what I used to call it, man. It's, in fact, this strategy I came up with, I don't know how many years ago, and I would give speeches and do podcasts and stuff. And then I had kids and kind of went inward and focused on a lot of self-growth and doing a lot of work. And then lately I've been focusing on entrepreneurialism. So my family never lives in poverty again, because I lived in poverty for some time and it was not good. Things are doing much better now. But it was amazing because Derek Brose took this idea and was like, hey, man, that John Bush guy, that's a great idea. And he took it and ran with it. And like, built this website, freedomcells.org, which I invite you guys to check out, please. And you can sign up. He started giving speeches about it. He just was all over the place. And he took the idea and spread it in a way that I never would have been able to. So I am eternally grateful and such a fanboy of Derek Brose for doing that. Take a look at these groups. And just to have this concept in my mind that I spoke about at speeches and wrote a little paper on and did some podcasts. And then Derek Brose went and made it freaking happen. And look at this. So this isn't just an idea, guys. This is counter economics. This is the phase two density agorism taking place right in front of our very eyes. The Cradle of Liberty. There's different groups. Vermont Freedom Cell, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Southwest Missouri, Agorist Land, Thailand. How cool is that? Jacksonville, Florida, Freedom Cell, UK. Look, some of these have their own. There's already 11 people. And there's groups in Australia, 13 members. Man, we're kicking ass. It's so exciting. Houston Freedom Cell. Yeah, that's going to be a big one. They're kicking ass. Look at all these different groups. This is the real deal, man. So let's go back to what I'm talking about. So now you agitate now. So it's like, okay, this guy, and this is how this can replace the state, because people like, they talk about a social safety net, and all the lefties are like, well, without a state, who's going to help the poor guy? Who's going to help the guy that needs medical attention? And this would be agorism too, because in a sense, it would counter economics would be its own kind of like insurance agency. So let's say, for example, there's a gentleman in this group of 10 right here, and his son breaks his leg and he's been out of work and his family's actually struggling. So he's like, first he goes to his group of 10. He's like, guys, I've been struggling, man. My son broke his leg and we're just starting to get things back. We're starting to get back on our feet. We were able to pay rent last month, but we just can't do anything else, right? So rather than going to the state for support, he can put out a call to this group of 100, this whole group. And they're like, hey, guys, this is one of our protocols. One of our group members who's low income, they have a broken leg. So if we all chip in, you know, X amount of dollars, 100 people chip in $50, that's $5,000. But let's say it's something catastrophic or crazy and we need to chip in, you know, it's like a $50,000 car accident or something. You go to this group. All right, everybody chips in $25, right? 25 of a thousand, that's 25,000. You're part of the way there. Another way that this ends up working, right? And before you know it, you know, we're talking about, we're just spreading this thing out. This thing's growing. This is crazy. I need to get a whiteboard is what I need to get. But for now, we're going to make it work. And so we've been talking about agorism. We got YouTube channels. We got shows. We got freedomcells.org. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And now we have a group of 10 freaking thousand. Now we're medium density agorist society all the way. And look how this works. The idea is to create defense agencies, defense networks, because as the agorism spreads, you're essentially developing a backstop. I remember early on in my political activism, we were trying to, what was it? Was it fluoride? We were trying to get fluoride out of the water in the city of Austin. We tried for like a decade. And I went to one of the council members. Maybe it was our Stop Vampire Cops. We were trying to prohibit the city from training police officers as phlebotomists to withdraw blood for blood withdrawal or for DWIs. We actually got that passed. But one of the council members, total chump, Mike Martinez, he's like, look, John, I want to support you, but I need a backstop. Help me have other people supporting. Give me the fortitude to stand up with this, right? And so essentially what this is helping people to be more brave. So maybe you don't feel comfortable defying the IRS and just standing up and saying, I'm not filing my income tax when it's just you and your eight buddies. But maybe you'd feel comfortable when there's 10,000 people that are all going to do it together in mass. Maybe this is 10,000 within a given geographic area. And you're all like, you know what? I didn't feel comfortable at the 1,000 level with this little group here of all these people. But I feel comfortable with 10,000 people all collectively saying, we're not going to pay our property tax. And the police officers are going to have a damn hard time enforcing that in mass. Another thing that could be like, wow, let's fundraise. Let's raise money through this 10,000 group to buy ammo for everyone, to equip those members that don't have Glock 19s, AK-47s, and AR-15s or body armor. Let's equip them by raising money through this. Let's all chip in, and through this infrastructure, let's get the land that we want to buy, right? And this whole thing could go global. And before you know it, you know, we're talking about 100,000 people. This isn't just some idea that we're talking about. This is agorism. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And it's already happening. Now we have a big ass group of 100,000 globally. We're participating. We're trading amongst ourselves. Another thing, like your plumbing goes out. This is why it's best that these are in certain geographic areas, but it doesn't have to be. You know, you're going to go to your cell of 1,000 to see if there's a plumber involved so you can keep the business within the family. So this is freedom cells. And this, in my opinion, is how we can get from phase one, low density agorist society, all the way into phase two, mid density, just making shit happen, competing with the state. This says that in phase two, pogroms can take place, mass arrests. And that's why, you know, it's not just going to be a couple buddies, but it's going to be this group of 10,000 in the Central Texas area or in the Houston area. You know, I bet if we keep agitating this and really doing the dirty work, you know, we can grow that between Houston, Dallas, the triangle, the Texas triangle, wherever. All right, I'm going to take some questions, and then we're going to finish out with phase three. Actually, let's just – so, yeah, eventually you create a high-density, large condensation agorist society, and it's in this time when the state is like, wow, we're actually competing with the agorist. They're providing services on the market that people prefer, like cryptocurrency, a way to do money in banking. There's the defense agencies that we're starting to work with. There's the Alternative Dispute Resolution Organization. Stefan Molyneux, love him or hate him, back in the day, it was all about just libertarianism and voluntarism. Then he got all right-wing fascist. But he talked a lot about DROs, Dispute Resolution Organization, how you can have justice in a free society. And the state at this point will probably start losing its shit. They're starting to lose their grip. They're going to start freaking out. They're going to throw a fit like a toddler would. And there's probably going to be some violence. And the beauty is, here's one way where I think we could get through these phases, especially from phase two to phase three. As the freedom cells grow, from your group of 1,000, you can have an ambassador. From your group of 10,000, you can have a little, you know, these are representatives. They don't have authority over the group of 10,000, but they are the public face. And they check this out. Each group elects one person. Chooses one person. Again, this isn't ruling over. This is what an infrastructure looks like a board of directors. Each group chooses one person, and that forms a group of 10, a council. This is like a council for this group of 100, and so on and so forth. Each one of these groups of 100 then chooses one representative. This group of 1,000 chooses one representative, right? And they form these councils, and it's these councils that can act as diplomats with the state. And so imagine you have 10,000 people and you all put out a Declaration of Independence and you're like, we're not complying with this, that, and the other. And it's like, we need to go to the negotiating table because we don't want violence. We're peaceful people. We're chilling, man. We just want to raise our family, do good work in this world, provide for goods and services, and do our own thing. So what can we do to resolve this? And I think it's at this point, if the numbers aren't large enough, where you can just be like, we have enough power to just say F you. So you've been so nasty to us. For generations, we're just going to do our own thing. And if you want to fight about it, I don't think it'll be in your best interest, right? That's not the approach I want to take. But I think as a transition from here to there, it can be like, look, here's the deal. We are no longer complying with A, B, C, and D. We own our property. We don't want to pay a tax for it. We don't want to participate in the health and human services.